Well, we come this morning in our series on Christ's cries from the cross to his fifth cry. These two small words that are very easy to skip over as we read through the narrative of Christ's suffering and death on Calvary. His cry, "I thirst." Now, it's a small statement to make, and we may look at these words and say, well, I suppose in a way it's obvious that he would be thirsting. He's been on the cross there for more than 6 hours, having first been scourged. No wonder he's thirsty. But is that all that these two small words have to tell us about these final moments of Jesus on the cross? Well, there's at least three things that we can draw out from these words. There are many more, in fact, but there are three that I would like to focus upon this morning. First of all, I'd like to point out that these verses show us that Jesus is a man. That Jesus is a man. And second, that these verses show us that Jesus is the Messiah. And thirdly, that these words tell us that Jesus is the sinner's substitute. Now, I don't think that we can say that any one of these is really more important than the other, but certainly the significance is there in each one and grows greater with each of these three points that I would like to draw out from this passage this morning. So first of all, that these words that Jesus cried from the cross indicate very clearly to us that Jesus is a man. He's a human being. He's like you and me. I already indicated right at the beginning of our series on Christ's cries from the cross that everything that Jesus says while he hangs on the cross, he says as the representative of mankind. He says in his capacity as God incarnate, God in the flesh. All the other statements that Jesus makes could be taken outside of that understanding. We could see each one of the cries of Christ from the cross as being that of the divine Messiah. And only that, and not understand the significance of the fact that Jesus had to be human, that Jesus had to be a man. He had to be fully man, not some kind of a superman. He had to be like you, like me. And this is one statement in these verses, in these cries that Christ makes, that points us to that conclusion, that Jesus is a man. Now, there are many other things. This isn't by itself conclusive, of course. I'm not trying to say this morning that if you took all the other references in the Gospels concerning Christ's humanity and you threw them away and you were left simply with this one, that this would be sufficient to prove that Jesus was a man. No, that's certainly not the case. But it is one of the evidences. It is one of the pointers to this fact. Let's go back over the events of the past few hours in the life of Jesus Christ. Traditionally, we have been led to understand that Jesus was crucified on a Friday. There is some debate over that, as I mentioned to the children in Sunday school last week. It's not a certainty. There are arguments that he may have died on the Wednesday rather than on a Friday to make up the 3 days till his resurrection. We won't go into all of that this morning. They're fascinating arguments, and people have decided and agreed to disagree on it. It's not crucial to the narrative. But whether it was Friday that Christ made this cry from the cross, or whether it was Wednesday, the fact is that he the events of the last 18 hours or so have been absolutely incredible for anyone to have borne. Middle of the afternoon on Wednesday or Friday, whichever one it may have been. The previous day, Jesus had been with his disciples. He had walked to Jerusalem, and he there in the evening had celebrated the Passover. There he had eaten with his disciples, having washed their feet, showing his willingness to be a servant to them and calling upon them to be servants to one another. And there he announced his imminent death. There he pointed out the one who would betray him, that man who immediately left the upper room to finalize his plans. From there, after instituting the Lord's Supper, Jesus made his way outside Jerusalem to a garden, the Garden of Gethsemane. And for a while there, Jesus prayed. His disciples were exhausted and they fell asleep. But Jesus prayed. And it wasn't just any prayer. It wasn't the simple repetition of things that he maybe prayed for day by day by day throughout his life. Jesus, we're told, was in agony in the garden. His agony was so great that his sweat was like drops of blood. Now, what we're to understand from that is that his sweat was drops of blood. It sounds like a simile, but have you ever seen drops of blood that you could compare sweat with? It doesn't make sense to use it as a simile. He sweat great drops like blood. No, his sweat was blood. Medical scientists have said that under great stress, under incredible strain, it's possible for the tiny blood vessels in the brow to burst and for the blood to mingle with the sweat so that you sweat blood. And this is the kind of stress that Jesus was under even before his crucifixion. There, on Thursday evening, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was in agony as he cried out to his Father that if it was possible that the events that lay immediately before him could be removed. But it was not possible. This was the plan. This was God's purpose. Jesus had to go on with it. And so at the conclusion of his praying, here comes Judas Iscariot, the one who would betray him, with a throng of people brandishing weapons, ready to seize him. And there at the edge of the garden, he was betrayed with a kiss. But that wasn't the end of it. He wasn't simply taken from there to be crucified. He then was taken to Caiaphas, the high priest. And there he went through a trial and found guilty of blasphemy. From there he was taken to Pilate, where he was again put on trial. And Pilate concluded that this wasn't an issue for him to deal with, so he sent him to Herod, where he was put on trial for a third time. And Herod, having tried him and found that there was nothing worthy of death, sent him back to Pilate, where he was put on trial yet again. All of this happening through the night. By 6 o'clock on Friday morning, Jesus stands before Pilate and is being condemned to death. But in the meantime, between leaving the garden under arrest to the point where he's pronounced guilty of no particular crime, but still guilty and worthy to die, between those times he's been mocked, he's been scourged, he's been beaten, he's been spat upon, he's had his beard plucked, he's been humiliated. And then, with a cross on his back, he is forced out of Jerusalem towards the hill on which he will be crucified. And there at 9 o'clock in the morning, he is nailed to that wooden cross and there hung to die, a long, excruciatingly painful death. There his whole body would be racked with pain. Those nails through his hands and feet would have just been a small, small part of the agony that he would have gone through over the next few hours. It was the most cruel death imaginable. Some have said it's the most cruel way man has invented to kill another man. And for hours and possibly days, a man could hang in agony before he eventually died. And Jesus, the time he makes this cry, has been on that cross for at least 6 hours. And there he makes this not astonishing cry, "I thirst." He's been bleeding from the wounds on his back, from his whippings. He's been bleeding from where they have pressed the crown of thorns onto his head. He's been bleeding from the wounds in his hands and in his feet, and through that great loss of blood, he has dehydrated and become parched. "I thirst," he says. Earlier the soldiers had mocked him, teased him with the sour wine. He'd been thirsting for hours. And now he cries out, "I thirst." It's the cry of a man, not a superman. It's a cry of a man who's gone through all these indignities and all this brutality and is suffering the effects of it all. He thirsts. He had thirsted before in his life. He'd gone to a well and asked for a drink before in his life, but it was nothing compared to what he's going through now in this situation. No doubt the men on either side of him have been crying out, "I thirst" as well. They were men. Here too was a man hanging on the cross. A man like me. A human being like you. One who suffered physically the torments that he had been put through. Jesus was a man. He had to be a man if he was ever to represent us before the judgment seat of God. He had to be one of us. And the writer to the Hebrews tells us that he became one of us in every way, except that he was without sin. And here, Jesus, in this small, simple, but significant way, gives evidence to the fact that like you and me, hanging on a cross, he was thirsty. But there's more to this. This cry also indicates that Jesus is the Messiah. He's the appointed one of God who would come into the world to free his people from their slavery, from their bondage. This was what the Messiah's purpose was. And this cry, as strange as it may seem, this cry indicates that Jesus was the Messiah. Again, as before, taken by itself without all the other references to his being the Messiah, this one wouldn't alone prove his being the Messiah. But it's part of all the evidence that proves his Messiahship. Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus knew what was going to happen to him. In Mark's Gospel, on a number of occasions, he indicated to his disciples what was going to happen to him. he started in, I think it's Mark chapter 8, and chapter 9 and verse 44. Oh, I've got the wrong text, I'm afraid. We'll go to the last section where he makes reference to his sufferings and his death in Mark's Gospel, and chapter 10, the third time when he predicts his sufferings and death. He says, "We are going up to Jerusalem." This is just before the Passover. "And the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles, and they will mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him, and the third day he will rise again." Jesus knew what was going to happen to him in such great detail. "We're going up to Jerusalem, and there I will be betrayed to the chief priests." And while in Jerusalem, Jesus is betrayed by Judas Iscariot to the chief priests and the guards of the temple. "And they will condemn him to death." And before Caiaphas, he was condemned to death for blasphemy. "And they will deliver him to the Gentiles." After seeing Caiaphas, he was taken to Pilate, who alone was able to sentence him to death. "And they," we're told, "will mock him and scourge him and spit on him and kill him." And all of those things happened. And they didn't simply happen because Mark, writing after the events, put these words in Jesus' mouth. We can maybe think along those lines, as many people have tried to argue, that this was just Mark trying to build up Jesus as being the Messiah. He had observed the things that had happened to Jesus. He had heard about the trial. He knew the circumstances under which Jesus had died. So he puts these words in his narrative concerning the life of Jesus. And he attributes this statement to Jesus himself. No, Jesus knew that this was going to happen to him. How did he know that these things were going to happen to him? Because someone who wrote before he was ever born wrote about these things. Many people wrote about these things. He was going to be betrayed. Psalm 41 tells us about that. In verse 9, "Even my own familiar friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me." Betrayal by a friend, a familiar friend, one who had spent time with him, eaten and drunk with him, would betray him. He would be forsaken by his friends. Psalm 31 and verse 11, "I am a reproach among all my enemies, but especially among my neighbors, and am repulsive to my acquaintances. Those who see me outside flee from me." Forsaken by those around him, even those close to him. He was tried and found guilty, but it was a false accusation. He had never committed any crime. In Psalm 35 and verse 11, "Fierce witnesses rise up. They ask me things that I do not know. They reward me evil for good to the sorrow of my soul." Now these psalms, they were written centuries before Jesus came. And these are prophecies concerning Jesus. David, who penned these psalms, as I said earlier in the service, was a type of Christ, a picture of Christ. And many of the words that David spoke and many of the incidents that he experienced were intended to foreshadow the things that Jesus would say and the things that Jesus, the Messiah, would experience. Jesus, when he was tried, didn't defend himself. Didn't say anything until he was put under oath and had to say something. He didn't try and convince people of his innocence. Isaiah 53, verse 7, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. As I've already said, he was guiltless, he was innocent, false accusations brought against him. But Isaiah goes on to say, he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. And yet he was hung on a cross to die. Isaiah in 53 goes on to say, he was numbered with the transgressors. The Psalms even talk about the way that Jesus would die. Psalm 22, and in verse 16, it makes reference to the crucifixion. There it says, dogs have surrounded me, the congregation of the wicked has enclosed me, they pierced my hands and my feet. A reference there to the piercing of the crucifixion. Such detail, pierced my hands and feet, and yet crucifixion was unknown at the time when David wrote this psalm. These were prophetic words concerning the Messiah and the way that he was to die. That psalm goes on to talk about the taunts and the mocking. Verses 7 and 8, all those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip, they shake their head saying, he trusted in the Lord, let him rescue him. Let him deliver him since he delights in him. The very things that happened while Christ was hanging on the cross. And while Christ hung there, he prayed to God, prayed for those who crucified him. He made intercession for transgressors, we're told. He prayed for them. Isaiah 53 has exactly those words. Not only that, but some of the other instances. Psalm 34, verse 20, speaks about the death of Jesus, the death of the Messiah, that in his death no bone would be broken. He guards all his bones, not one of them is broken. And yet, the other two men who were crucified on the crosses to each side of Jesus, had their legs broken to speed up the death of those criminals so that it would all be over before the Jewish Sabbath. But Jesus, he was found already to be dead. They proved it by thrusting a spear into his side and out flowed blood and water, a sign of death. But his leg wasn't broken, fulfilling prophecy. And then his burial. Isaiah chapter 53 makes mention of his burial. And in verse 9 of Isaiah 53, they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death. And indeed he was put in a tomb that wasn't his own, that was donated by a wealthy friend with the rich. In his death, even there. You see, Jesus' knowledge of his impending death and the great sufferings that he would go through hasn't been put there simply by his biographers pretending that he knew these things. He knew these things because they'd been prophesied in such incredible detail. And it isn't as if Jesus could have orchestrated all of these things. Some of the things he could do. Being prophesied that he wouldn't open his mouth. Well, he could keep silence in order to fulfill that prophecy. that he had no control over how he would die. He was handed over to the Gentiles to be crucified. Well, he had no control over that, did he? Earlier in his life, the Jews had tried to stone him to death. Why didn't they do it now? They could have done. They tried once. Why not again? You see, so many of these prophecies were completely outside of the control of Jesus Christ, and yet they were all fulfilled. Fulfilled to the smallest detail. I mean, we would understand things like his being crucified, a significant point to make like that being prophesied, and Jesus fulfilling that. You know, we would understand the importance of a significant prophecy like his bones not being broken and Jesus fulfilling that. We would understand the significance of the fact that he was mocked and ridiculed, that he was scourged and spat upon, and these great things all being prophesied about. And we would understand it if the New Testament writers drew attention to all of those things. They're important things. They're significant things. They're vital things. If any one of those was left out, well, you know, we would be in doubt as to whether Jesus was really the Messiah or whether we should still wait for the one who would fulfill that last significant thing. But in order to emphasize the fulfillment of all of the prophecies concerning Jesus and his death, John draws our attention to this one, in order that the scriptures might be fulfilled. Jesus said, "I thirst." What a simple, small thing to talk about and to draw attention to. Why does he do it? Well, because it points to the fact that he's the Messiah. It does it in this way. If Jesus fulfilled such a tiny, insignificant prophecy, along with the great prophecies concerning his death, what right have we to doubt that he was the fulfillment of the messianic prophecies? Psalm 22 talks, there David talks about his tongue cleaving to the roof of his mouth, and in Psalm 69, which we read earlier, which is where this statement comes from, the fulfillment of the scriptures, the things that Jesus has in mind, is Psalm 69 and verse 21. "They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink." And John tells us that so that the scriptures would be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I thirst," and a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there. They filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on hyssop, and put it to his mouth. "For my thirst, they gave me vinegar to drink." Sour wine. The very thing that the prophecy had spoke of. Because he thirsted. A tiny thing, but so significant. Because if any of the prophecies, even the smallest of the prophecies, had remained unfulfilled by Jesus, we would have legitimate doubt to question whether he was truly the Messiah. But we have no doubt at all. Every prophecy, even the smallest, was fulfilled by Christ. So Jesus is a man, but Jesus is the Messiah. And then thirdly and finally, this cry of Christ from the cross tells us that Jesus is the sinner's substitute. And you look at this and you say, how on earth do you get that out of these two little words? Jesus, the sinner's substitute, from a cry, "I thirst"? Well, it's definitely there. You see, as I've already said, Jesus had to be man. He had to be human to truly be our substitute. He had to be like us in every way, but without sin, if he was to represent us before God, take our place before God, stand before God and go on trial before God in our place. Jesus had to be like us. He couldn't just be something like us, a little bit like us, not even a lot like us. He had to be exactly like us. And Jesus was, as I've already sought to argue. And he was the substitute. He was the representative. He was the Messiah. And this cry points us to the fact that Jesus, as a man and as the Messiah, took our place. He cried, "I thirst." Why did Christ thirst? Well, he was under such physical pain, of course. It's no wonder that he thirsted under having gone through the things that he did, as we've already observed. But all of those things point us to something else as well. And I would draw your attention to a story that Jesus spoke about in Luke's Gospel and chapter 16. You remember the story about the rich man and Lazarus? That great wealthy man who had everything his heart could wish for, who died. And Lazarus, that poor beggar who sat and begged at the rich man's gate, who also died. You'll remember how Lazarus was taken to heaven. And you'll remember how the rich man was taken to hell. And we're told in verse 24 of Luke's Gospel, chapter 16. He cried out, the rich man cried out and said, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame." He's tormented. He's thirsty because of his physical torment as he is there in hell suffering for his sins. And Jesus' statement, "I thirst," follows immediately after his last cry, my God, why have you forsaken me?" All of those last four cries follow on from one another in very quick succession. He's been under the wrath of God because, as a representative of mankind, he has taken upon himself the sins of his people. And God has been punishing him because of those sins. And he's turned his back on him. He's forsaken him. He's no longer blessing him. He's no longer encouraging and strengthening him. Jesus has just gone through the most incredible anguish we could ever think of as he has hung upon the cross there. This isn't simply the physical, though it is the physical, certainly it is that. And Jesus' cry is a valid response to the physical suffering he's been through. But he's gone through more than that. Just as that rich man suffered physical anguish in hell and called to be given some kind of relief from it, so Jesus, hanging on the cross, suffers incredible physical anguish that goes beyond the simple natural response to the act of crucifixion. Part of the physical response is one of the forsaking of God. That God has departed. It's something that we cannot fully appreciate, because even here, even in this world, whether we believe in God or we don't believe in God, God is here. And he's being merciful to us day by day. And we do not fully understand the degree to which God is at work in our lives, whether we're Christians or not. And the degree to which God protects us and helps us through our life in this world. But all of that has gone when Jesus hangs on the cross. And just as that rich man in hell suffered physical anguish as part of the punishment for his sins, so Jesus suffers far more than the pain of being crucified. He suffers from the forsaking of God in a physical way, as well as in a spiritual way. And he cries out, "I thirst." But I believe there's more to it than that as well. It's certainly a physical thing that's going on here, but I believe too that it is a spiritual thing. Christ has been forsaken by God. He's been turned away from God. He's bearing the punishment of his people's sins. And he cries out, "I thirst." Jesus once met a woman by a well in Samaria. And as he spoke to that woman, he asked her for a drink. He'd been travelling, he'd been speaking, preaching, and he was thirsty, and he called for a drink. And then he went on to have a conversation with her. And he said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." He went on to say, "Whoever drinks this water," that is the water from the well, "will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." That woman was thirsty, but she didn't really know it. She didn't fully appreciate it. That woman there had a need, and Jesus pointed it out to her and said that he could fulfill that need in her life. And the truth is that we all have that need. We all have a thirst that, for some of us, we've been able to put out of our minds and out of our thoughts and sort of turn from it so that we don't sense it, we don't feel it, perhaps as we ought to. But this woman came to appreciate her need. And I believe that Jesus' cry from the cross is part of this reflection of a need. He says, "I thirst." What does he thirst for? Well, yes, he thirsts for water. He wants that drop of water on his tongue because of the physical anguish he's going through. But he's going through spiritual anguish as well. The psalmist talks about a thirsting for God. And I believe that that's partly what's wrapped up in this statement here. That Jesus thirsts for God. He's already, just moments earlier, cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And here he is, bearing the sins of his people, being punished in their place, and he cries out, "I thirst." Yes, there's the physical, but there's this spiritual dimension to it as well. Something that he has known for all eternity past, the presence of God, the love of God. And it's gone. And he thirsts for it. And he thirsts for it because it's been taken away from him. And it's been taken away from him because he is being a substitute. He is experiencing the things that those whom he's a substitute for should experience. And he has lost the blessings that he had before he was a substitute. And he cries out, "I thirst. I thirst for those things that have gone. I long to be with God, to have all of those blessings once again, to be free from bearing the punishment for these sins." This verse, these words, point us to Jesus as a substitute. Why is he thirsting there, both spiritually and physically? Because he's taken the place of his people. Jesus is a man, and he suffers because of it. Jesus is a Messiah, and he suffers because of it. Jesus is a substitute for sinners, and he suffers because of it. All that Jesus did on the cross was an act of obedience to the Father. It was fulfilling the plan of redemption. Everything that Jesus did in life and death was part of this plan to save his people from their sins. And Jesus, as he surveyed the scriptures, even as he hung on the cross, was concerned to make sure that he fulfilled every prophecy, that he did all that was necessary to complete that plan of redemption. And here in this cry, he does one more thing to ensure that it's all accomplished. He cries out, "I thirst." And that draws the response of those who bring him the wine vinegar to drink. And so he fulfills yet another prophecy. Let me ask you, Christian, this morning, how seriously do you take the scriptures and the obligations that God's word puts on you? You see, Jesus here on the cross, he was a man. He was a Messiah. He was the substitute for sinners. He had done so much for his people. And yet, he wasn't going to allow even the tiniest, simplest little thing to escape his notice. He wasn't going to fail in any point at all. He made sure that he fulfilled the scriptures as far as it was in his control to do. And he did it. And the scriptures place obligations on you. It placed an obligation on Christ. He, the second person of the Godhead, had agreed with his Father to accomplish this work. And he did it. He obeyed God's command. He fulfilled the scriptures. But you, as a follower of Jesus Christ, are placed under obligation by the word of God. You are called upon to be holy, even as God is holy. You're called upon to obey his word. You're called upon to be a witness for him in this world. You are an ambassador, as it were, for Christ. You have a ministry of reconciliation to share with others. And you're under obligation to do this. How seriously do you take God's word? Even as Christ hung on the cross there between those two thieves. Even as he suffered great anguish. Even through those 6 hours, he went over the things that he knew. What must be done? What must be done? What must be done? And there towards the end, this scripture must be fulfilled. They gave him gall to eat, sour wine to drink. And so he cries, "I thirst." Have you reviewed your life? Do you examine yourself? Where am I failing to do my duty before God? Where is my witness before others falling down? Where am I holding on to secret sins? Do you take the scriptures seriously? Are you striving to fulfill them with God's help? And to those of you who are not Christians this morning, let me appeal to you to consider the evidence that the scriptures give concerning Jesus Christ, who he claimed to be. We have observed this morning that in an incredible way, Jesus fulfilled the prophecies spoken hundreds of years before he was born. And he fulfilled them in the smallest of details. Can you just shrug these things off lightly? Or will you take them seriously? And will you consider the implications of what Jesus did? Jesus there as a substitute, taking the place of sinners. You're a sinner. Did Jesus take your place? Where he hung in agony on the cross? Did he cry out because of the were bearing the punishment for your sins? These are things that ought to be examined and considered carefully. And I would urge you to do this.